Okay, Dave, we're back on, we're now on tape two, and I just to make sure, you were telling me about your Princeton academics, and you mentioned you were magna cum laude.
I got a BSE in basic engineering, and my honors were as a magna cum laude.
All right. Your dad had gotten a degree in engineering from Michigan, if
he
I recall.
He also had honors, I think, at the University of Michigan in 1915.
Right. But even though you did stay the full 4 years, and what was, again, the year of graduation?
1953.
You did not maintain your eligibility for that last year, and why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, while I was at Princeton during the off season, I'd have to come back. My first year, I came back to St. Louis and played in that same semi-pro league for Barford Chevrolet. The second year, I went to Whitensville, Massachusetts, and pitched for the Whitensville team. That's a little industrial textile town outside of Worcester.
Yes.
And I played there. And then my third year, after my junior year, I played for a year out in Storm Lake, Iowa, and with that town team. The Storm Lake Lakers, I think they were. I forget what they were, but I was getting some pretty good experience in playing in some pretty good baseball. But my brother George was at that point, I think, was in the Cardinal chain or high up in the Cardinal air chain with the, and I think he was assigned to Omaha at that point. I'm not sure of that, but he told me I stopped in St. Louis on the way back to, I stopped to see him or saw him someplace, and he told me that there was a rule coming around in professional baseball and of course these baseball teams at that point were paying these kids $100,000, and they'd go out and buy a rigged up Cadillac and get married and do whatever, and then they'd bunch of them would never make it, you know, through the minor leagues to the major leagues.
Is this what we used to call the bonus babies?
Bonus babies. So they were trying to get rid of the bonus babies at that point because there was no television money or anything. And so he said there was going to be a rule that if you signed for more than $6,000 that you had to be on a major league roster. That was the way they were going to control it. And so I knew that rule was coming, or at least I had my brother's advanced knowledge that it was coming. So if I was going to get more than $6,000, I had to sign before this rule came in.
Sure.
So I let about four or five teams know that I was interested in signing, and I went and worked out with the Yankees, and I worked out with the Red Sox had seen me up in Massachusetts when I was up there. The Cardinals had an interest. And I think Pittsburgh had a little small interest because that's where my dad was at this point. He had moved from the Dodgers to the Pittsburgh. So the Red Sox at that point were signing people, I think, a little bit more readily than other people. And I didn't think twice about it. I just, they came in and offered me $40,000 and I signed.
Well, at that time, that was a pretty hearty chunk of money, wasn't it?
Well, that's, I've got a home in St. Louis right now. It's worth a lot more than that, and that's where that money is.
If I recall, when we had talked before, you mentioned that at some point, even before you had learned about the rule on bonuses, that Branch Rickey had expressed some interest, and if I recall, you had turned him and his team down at that point you wanted to go on and get your college education.
In all honesty to you, I heard that story, and that story may have been between Branch Rickey and my father, but I was never aware of that offer, and I think probably at that time I would have turned it down, but I actually never did turn it down.
Okay.
Can you tell factually for me whether there ever was such an offer?
And the best of your knowledge at that point, when the when George Jr., your older brother, told you about that, was the first time you'd seriously considered
Right.
Giving up any eligibility to enter the pros.
And I probably think to this day I might have made a mistake. I don't know. I think I let a lot of people at Princeton down by not playing that senior year, and not that it was any of that big thing, and nor did I think that they would have come along and given me a whole lot of money, because I had to remember now, going at that time, if you went to college, you had to go in the Army after that. So I had 2 years in the Army to go through.
That's what I was going to ask you. Once you signed with the Red Sox, and by the way, who signed you? Do you recall the scout or the...
Oh, boy, I do know that name is... I'll think of it here while we're talking, but I... classy guy. I forget who it was, but the classy guy... Neil Mahoney.
Oh, Neil Mahoney.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, that name's familiar. And the general manager at that time was Joe Cronin. Is that right?
Sure right? Was.
And Tom Yawkey was the owner.
Right.
When you signed with them, you were still going to. That was with the understanding that you were going to finish your education.
Finish my education and then go in the Army, too.
And they knew that going in, so that wasn't a shock to them. So
No. Basically
then, once you graduated from Princeton, you went into the service.
No. When I graduated from Princeton, I reported, I had in my contract that I would get a shot at the Louisville baseball team.
Which was their, was
triple,
that their?
It was their AAA team.
AAA team.
And so when I there was a short period by the time my last classes were there and my exams were over till when I had to go back to graduate. I think it was about 10 days. So I went to and visited I joined the Louisville club. And when I got there, I saw they were fighting for the pennant, and they had a pretty well set pitching staff, and they were pretty well had veteran players all over the place. I stayed with them for a week, through batting practice and stuff, and they didn't activate me because I was going to be gone. I had to go back to college, so I called. Mike Higgins was the manager.
Is that what the guy we call Pinky?
Pinky Higgins was the manager.
Right.
And I called him on the phone one day, and I said, Pinky, I said, I know you've got this requirement to try and get me a spot on this team. I said, I see you're pretty well set in your pitching staff. He says, why don't you send me out to Albany, which was their A Eastern League team, and I'll that way I'll pitch because I got to go in the service at the end of this year anyway. So he said fine, and so that got him off the hook, and they sent me to Albany, and I won 12 games there at Albany.
Okay, so you did have a minor league career, because I did not know that. I was not aware of that.
It was from the middle of June on, I think it was.
Okay, and do you recall who the manager there was at all?
Yeah, a fellow named Burns.
Okay.
Burnes. And he happened to end up on the Red Sox as a coach, too.
I see.
But this ties in to what's going to happen later, because... So then I went to Fort. Then I asked the Red Sox. I said, "Is there any place where you have any pool where I can play baseball while I'm in the service?" And they said, "Well, we do have some pool down here at Fort Dix." He says, "If you can somehow get to Fort Dix." Well, Fort Dix wasn't a problem for me because I was now my legal resident was in Brooklyn, New York.
I see, because that's where your parents were at that point.
That's right.
Yeah.
So at the I somehow agitated the Selective Service Board in Brooklyn to, okay, now I'm ready, get me, take me in. And so they put me on their roster in February of 54 is when I went in. And I went down to do the good old foot of Manhattan and stepped forward and went in the U.S. Army there, got to Fort Dix, said, I'm a big shot coming here from the Red Sox. Here I am. They said, who?
They had no idea.
They had no idea. And there was just by luck, 4 months later, I got I met somebody, you know, it was a long story. I don't want to go through all that, but it was really tied into my brother's success with the Phillies. I met some guy who assigned where people went, and when I went to the place to hear where everybody was supposed to go, the three off the top were Abrams and the guy named Ahern or something like that, and then Sisler. And so I got sent to Fort Dix. I got sent to Fort Meade.
Fort Dix is New Jersey.
Fort Dix was New Jersey, proving grounds for my next 8 months.
And that's in Maryland.
And then then I was assigned to an anti-aircraft battery that protected Baltimore. At those times, they had a battery there that was headquartered out of Fort Meade, which is halfway between Baltimore and Washington.
I see.
So then I was there, and I got on their post team, and because I had won 12 games in Class A ball, so they were looking for a pretty good pitcher. And then I played basketball there, and I did. Turned out I was a football manager, and then I played baseball again and basketball again, and then I got out of there from there. So I had a nice career in the U.S. Army. But the other part, the funny story, was that while I was there, the Red Sox called, and they needed a pitcher to pitch the Jimmy Fund game.
In Boston?
In Boston.
Uh-huh.
It was a trip, which was a game that they did for charity. Every summer, and at Fenway Park, and Frank Baumann had pitched the year before, and they always tried to pick somebody up out of their minor league system or else out of the Army, some prospect they had that they could bring in and pitch because they didn't want to use one of their pitchers.
Sure.
So they asked, could I come, and I got a 5-day furlough and went up to Boston. And there was Mike Higgins, and there was Dave Ferris, the pitching coach, both of who were at Louisville when I called and told them that, hey, I'll let you off the hook. I'll go pitch at Albany.
And by then, Higgins was managing the Red Sox.
Yes, he was managing the Red Sox, and I had won 12 games at Albany, so which was exactly what I told him I wanted to do.
And then that's Dave, what we call Boo Ferris, if I remember right.
Right.
Yeah, I have interviewed him.
Very, one of the nicest men you ever met.
Really, really terrific guy to talk to. It really was. So you went up there, and that was probably before a fairly large crowd then, if it was a Jimmy Fund game.
Frankie Lane did the preliminaries, and the game didn't start till about 10 o'clock. And it only was 7 innings, and I won that game. So it was 3-2. And Paul Giel, remember the old player for the Minnesota Gophers?
Absolutely.
He pitched for the New York Giants that same day. So anyway, I pitched in that game and did a fairly decent job, and then went back and got out of the Army. So
that's amazing.
That's how small the world is.
Just so I'll know for the record, I think Giel was G-I-E-L, wasn't he? Isn't that how he
I don't remember
that?
G-E-I-I-I.
Or G-E-I, I can't remember, but I remember a pretty famous name in Big
only
Ten
four
sports.
Four letters, and it's either E-I or I-E, and I think it's I-E, but I'm not sure.
So that's amazing that your first big-time professional game was in front of a huge crowd like that.
Of course, I'd been to so many ballparks and stuff, it wasn't that great a thing, but it was useful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So when did you then finally get your discharge from the service?
February the 23rd. But before then...
And that was 1954?
56.
56, excuse me. I missed it. Yeah.
So that's those 2 years. I was in the total 24 months. But meanwhile, the Red Sox had sent me a letter saying that they were having a camp for their prospects. And did I have any leave left over? Of course, I did have some leave left over. And for the last two weeks before then, I got to go to the Red Sox to a minor league camp, which was held in Sarasota. So I got down to Sarasota and did very well at their camp because I was throwing I was pitching. I was throwing the ball up in up in Maryland when I was, you know, I was getting ready for it. And I got down there, and they said, I'm never forget I'm saying this. They said, look, don't try and impress anybody. No one's going to get promoted or demoted based on their performance at this camp. And I was just thinking to myself, BS. I'm going to try it. Because I didn't know of the rule at that point. There was a rule that if you came out of the service, you didn't count on the major league roster.
Oh, okay.
If you were a returning, if you're getting out of the service, in order to sort of help those people out, you'd be sort of a person that, you'd be the 26th man if you could make the major league team.
Yeah, no penalty for keeping you on the roster.
Right.
There's a lot more incentive and chance you'll get to stay there for a while.
And then looking at this from the Red Sox point of view, I was, you know, I'm not getting to be any spring chicken at this point, and I've only played 1.5 year in the minors. So this was a way of them sort of seeing what kind of a medal I had. So I, halfway through it, Higgins came over to me and said, we'd like you to come to the major league camp, which was, you know, was that a blessing. So I went up back to Maryland, got out of the Army, and flew back for the major league camp, got out of the service.
And was the Jimmy Fund game also in 1956? Or
no, that was in 1955.
55. Okay, so now we're up to 1956, and you're actually reporting for spring training.
Right, with the Red Sox.
And where did they spring train at that point?
Sarasota.
Okay. And then just tell me a little bit about that, and just, you know, looking at your record here, I realize that was the year that you made the team.
Well, I had a fabulous Red Sox spring, because they even hit a home run the first time I was batting, first game I played in, and pitched, and I think I had 4 or 5 outings, you know, as you do in spring. You start off with 3 innings, and then you pitch another 3, and whatever. And so each time I pitched once against the Dodgers in Miami. I pitched against the Cardinals in St. Pete, I believe. I pitched against Cincinnati at Sarasota. I pitched against the Braves in Sarasota. I know, I had 4 or 5 outings, and did fairly well. And, of course, they had just gotten Bob Porterfield, and they were going to go for the pennant. They also had picked up Mickey Vernon at that point. And this was, they were going to go for the pennant was their attic. And Williams was back, and he was in good shape. He had come back in 55, and from this Korean War.
Right.
So they were ready to go. And so I was the 11th man on the pitching staff, or 12th. I was the 26th man on the roster, and I arrived in Boston.
Yeah, well, that's terrific that you got that extra break, and you made good with it, it sounds like.
Oh, it was great. And it was just, that was just one of the fabulous years I had in sports, was in 1956.
Now, I pulled some of the records for that 1956 team, finished 4th, I guess, in the American League, according to the records I have here. But they had a good record, 84-70. That's a nice,
right. Nice
record. Maybe not as good, obviously, as they wanted, based on what you just said. But, and it looks like they had quite a lineup too. So.
Oh, the great part from my viewpoint is I started on the low end of the voting ball, and just as I got there, the two guys that they were using as closers got hit a little bit. And so I was down in the bullpen, and I think I had pitched once in New York, 1 inning, and then I don't know if I had ever pitched against then, and I was there, and I was in a... Oh, it was against the Yankees. And the Yankees up in Fenway Park. And Mantle was batting, and the bases were loaded, and the Red Sox were ahead by 2 runs, I think, or something like that. That was in the 8th inning or something like that. And sure enough, they brought me into the game.
So this was your first official appearance in the big leagues?
No, this wasn't my first. This was my first one was in New York, just in a mop-up situation.
But I see.
But all of a sudden, I was in there because their other guys had gotten hit a little bit, and I lucked out. I got people out, and then we rallied and went ahead more, and then I got them out in the 9th inning. So suddenly I'm the main closer, which went on for about 2 or 3 weeks, and I did okay. Saved a couple of games, but then I screwed one up pretty badly, and pretty soon I wasn't doing that much anymore, and I was more of a middle, and then I started pitching better, and then about the mid-year, they said you're going to start, so now I'm starting, and so then my record was pretty much always 50-50 in that year. I ended up 9-8, which was good.
Yeah,
had some saves.
Yeah, for a rookie, it was very good. For anybody, it was good.
But I had a fairly high ERA, and that was that park is tough to pitch in, especially when the wind's blowing out. But
mm-hmm.
and especially with the way I pitched, and so I was so it was a fabulous year for me in sports to have made the Red Sox and have won nine games.
If I have this right, you were what, in 1956, about 24 years old, 20,
yeah.
right in that neighborhood. Here you are in the big leagues, and I've got you down at getting in 39 games that year.
Yeah, 25 years old, because I was born in 31, and then that was 56, so that'd be 25.
Yeah, 25, right? Yeah, you're right, 25. And then and I had you starting 14 games, so that's pretty good for your first year.
Yeah.
And having been away, even though you say you played baseball during those years, it's still you were away from, the professional game and not playing minor league ball.
Right.
So that was pretty good. What do you remember about any stories about any of your teammates or anything that stand out?
Oh, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff that stand out over the years. That I was just so thrilled to be there. My locker was right next to Jimmy Pearsall's on Shipout Row. he had the main locker, and then there was two lockers right to the right of his, which were right outside the manager's office. And so the manager didn't have to walk very far to tell him that they were going back to the minors or anything. So
that's what they called that, huh?
Yeah, that's what he called it.
That's what Jimmy called it?
Yeah.
Was he everything everybody said about him? Or?
He was a hot ticket. He was something else. But he was crazy smart. He was always, he wasn't crazy, he was crazy smart. But he had a way to always get the fans to aroused, because they always thought he was crazy. But and he did some crazy things, I think, earlier, but not when I was there.
And from my memory of him, he was always considered to be a terrific outfielder.
Fabulous, especially in a confined area like Boston was. He was the best I ever saw in a confined center field, where you had to go close to the wall.
Sure.
But if you had unlimited area to cover, I think they were a lot better, because there were a lot of people that could run faster and had more range. But and he couldn't. He had hurt his arm in a contest. Some kind of an exhibition contest where he hurt his arm, I think, when he threw against Willie Mays or something like that. But he didn't have a good, strong arm, but he could really catch the ball. I mean, he was fabulous at catching the ball. And but he was, and there were a big, aloof group, the Red Sox were. There's none of this high-fiving every time you got somebody out, or every time a guy hit a home run, everybody would go around and shake his hand or anything. There's no stuff like that. This is a big group of professionals that sort of did their own thing and had their own. They all drove to the park by themselves and left by themselves, and pretty much a. Not such a no clanny group at all.
What about now? You also had Jackie Jensen on that team.
Right.
What was he like?
He's a class person. Mm-hmm. Very, very classy. Stuck to himself. Very professional. Did his own thing.
And
fit right into the mold of the rest of them.
And you being a rookie, how were you received by, say, a guy like, well, you had a couple of real veterans in Ted Williams, and Mickey Vernon by then was an older player, too.
Yeah, we you know, Vernon was one of the very, very nice guy who I eventually played for at Washington when he was a manager. But Vernon was very, very, you know, classy, quiet, kept to his own business, nice, nice man. Williams was a big, you know, vociferous person. I don't know what would have been, if he had gone to college, what he would be like, but, you know, he was very, very bright, loud, kept to it. Again, he was older, and the first thing he ever said to me was, he looked at me, he says, "I thought you were a big guy." Here I am, 6'5", 200, and he says, "I thought you were a big guy." So, you know, you know, he was, he didn't like, I was a, again, my, the way I pitched is, you know, I probably, for his standing out there in left field watching me pitch, you know, I probably went to so many more long counts and stuff that he didn't particularly care for the way I pitched. But, and of course, he didn't think any pitcher had to, could throw the ball by him or could do anything that could get him out. So, you know, he didn't respect that one pitcher had better stuff than the other one. It's just how they pitched.
Sure.
And so he stayed away, pretty much. He just sort of stayed away. His locker was way at the other end of the room. And shower the same way. And, you know, he didn't come home from the ballpark on the bus. He always, or get there on the bus. You know, occasionally he'd come on the bus, but not very often.
I see.
He stuck to himself. Very few guys could say that they were on the team that I saw could say that they were close to him. He had his own friends and his own town and whatever he did. You know, he was single.
Mm-hmm. What? Tell me a little bit about how, and maybe it didn't make any difference at all. Were you treated any differently because you were the son of not only a baseball player, another, you know, professional ball player, but you were also the son of a rather famous baseball player, a Hall of Fame baseball player?
No, never. And there was never anything along those lines. I always was treated the same.
Okay.
I don't know no, I can't remember any, because, you know, Dad had nothing to do with Boston, and so maybe if I had gone with Pittsburgh, which is where he was, or at Brooklyn, where he was, it might have been different, but not certainly in Boston.
The reason I ask is that there were some articles that I read when I was writing your dad's biography that talked about how Dick, being a first baseman, had like his father, had received some tough times, you know, early on in his career before he established himself, because of the fact that he was George's son, and apparently maybe the fact you were a pitcher or you know, with a different organization didn't come up in your career, I guess.
Oh, about my brother, I think I've also read that, and I to this day doubt it, because I don't think anybody put too much pressure, because Dad never let anybody put pressure. He didn't have any pressure on us to play ball.
Mm-hmm.
Dick had more pressure on him to get good grades in school than he had to hit a baseball. There may have been people that made comparisons because he tried, when he played first base, that, you know, Dad was such a great fielder, and that was one of Dick's shortcomings at first base, that he wasn't the greatest fielder around. But Dick was a big, strong hitter, and I don't think it bothered him much. And for sure it didn't bother me. I never had the comparison. A couple of times, I can remember in the batting cage when I swung and missed the ball, one of the grizzly old guys would say, "Boy, George wouldn't have been proud of that swing," or something like that. But it was always done good-naturedly.
Oh, sure.
But
sure.
I don't know. It wasn't much. That part really was never much of a problem or an excuse I could have. In fact, I thought, especially during high school, it focused, and maybe in college, it focused more attention on me and gave me more the ability to shine. And if I did shine, it would be recognized quicker than if I wasn't related to George Sisler.
So it was a positive.
Total positive.
Okay. Now, the pitching staff, I just wanted to go over that a little bit. There, you had mentioned Bob Porterfield. I know those, that was still also the era of Mel Parnell.
Yeah, he's a nice man.
And any other pitchers on the staff that stand out or that you know?
Well, I had known Frank Sullivan when I pitched it at Albany.
Okay.
While I was Albany, he got promoted to the Red Sox. And he was a big, strong, 6'7" or 6'8" right-hander, ex-Army man from Korea. And he was always a nice guy. And there was Tommy Brewer, who was a good pitcher with a great curveball. And then Ike DeLock, who would come up through their system and he could throw the ball hard.
He was more a relief pitcher, if I recall.
Yeah, then there was, he was. And then there's Willard Nixon.
Yes.
Who used to pitch against the Yankees a lot, and he had a good knuckleballer, and it was just didn't quite have the stuff to be a great pitcher, but it was almost there. And then, he was a toughie. He had a big temper, big strong Southern gentleman from Georgia. And there's Leo Kiley, and he's a left-hand pitcher.
Uh-huh.
And of course, Frank Baumann was there because I knew him from St. Louis. Then there was Billy Mong Boquette came in at my last year there, and I got to know him pretty well. And well, there's a bunch of them that came in and out.
Sure. Yeah, I suppose over the years, some of the different teams and who was on them kind of meld together a little bit.
Sure. Yeah,
but I see a lot of these players that you're naming on the various teams. I wanted to go back one more question about that first year. And a book a few years ago, quite a few years ago, came out. In fact, your dad, I think, was one of them that was interviewed.